Looking for a graduation gift to inform, inspire, and encourage? When you give a subscription to Christianity Today, you're giving redemptive, relevant news and thoughtful, balanced dialogue about the church, current issues, and public theology. Visit orderct.com/graduate gifts to get a discounted student subscription for the graduates in your life. Starting at only $2 per month, this gift will engage and grow their faith throughout the year. Click the link in the show notes or visit orderct.com/graduate gifts to order now.
This is CT Media.
Welcome to Being Human. Obviously, I'm Steve Cuss, a fellow human, and I'm thrilled to have a guest with me in the studio who's been not just a dear friend of mine for over a decade, but also a co-laborer in our organization, Capable Life. We help people lower reactivity in the workplace and home place. Jimmy and his wife, Mariana, work with us. So Jimmy, welcome to Being Human.
Yeah, excited to be here.
Yeah. You're not new to podcasting together.
Yeah.
Well, you're not even new to being a human.
Right. Yeah. I've been doing that for a while.
Yeah, a little while. But you are new to being human.
So, that's right. Officially.
So, you know, a lot of our watchers and listeners know you. You've been on several episodes of MLA, but we have a whole new community here with Christianity Today. I thought it'd be great just to start if you just tell us a bit about your journey into all of these tools that we teach.
These tools is something that I feel like found me versus I went out and looked for them. I came to Colorado actually to be a helicopter pilot. And found myself working for your church as the director of worship arts. And so I got the opportunity to learn these tools from you. I wore a bunch of hats at that organization, 11 years there, ended as the director of operations. So whether it was AV or worship arts or facilities or media or IT or communications, finance, like all around the church, the common thread was that there was always staff members or volunteers that I was able to use these tools and become a more capable leader. So I think I first was using them to with the context of how can I be more effective as a leader? But really, I just found that it really changed the way that I showed up as a father and as a husband and a brother and a friend. And so I'm a lifer. I'm going to be pursuing these tools forever because it's made a huge impact on me.
Yeah. So you were one of my first students when I first started cooking up how do we actually teach this and so on in the first cohort. And then you became a coach and now you lead that cohort.
Yeah.
I still have trouble telling people what it is we do. How would you describe what we actually do that might help people understand?
Yeah. Wow. That's thanks for throwing that to me. Yeah. Something that you have struggled with for a while.
Yeah. Just a few years.
Just do it succinctly. I think that the most succinct I can be is we help people pay attention to what's going on just under the surface in them first, and then they can start paying attention to what's happening around them. So especially in leadership positions, people they lead, but really just in anytime you're around other humans, you begin to form emotional connections and you're interconnected. So you swap anxiety with each other. And if you can start paying attention to it, then you don't have to automatically react to it. You actually get some choice into what you do. So you can stay more connected to the people you're around.
Yeah. So then again, for our long-term podcasters, a lot of this is kind of recap for them.
Yeah.
But for our newer folks, one of the tools that we've been introducing is learning how to notice when you're bigger or smaller than human.
Yeah.
I wonder if you'd just tell us a bit about how you would explain that.
Yeah, with all these tools, I think it's important to notice first in yourself. And so I notice in myself getting bigger and smaller. Mm. I want control. I don't always have to be in control, but if I'm a part of something, I want it to go the way that I want it to go. And when things aren't going that way, then I definitely find myself getting bigger, trying to use either more words or take control to try and fix it or improve it. So if I know the answer, then I'm likely to get bigger. And then if I'm afraid or I don't have the answer, especially if I've developed a name for myself of being the guy that has the answer and I don't know, then I can get smaller. But the way I see it in other people usually is the telltale signs of somebody using the most words in a meeting, body posture, things like that, getting bigger. But then also getting smaller would be, you know, eyes down to the ground or not saying much when you're called upon, kind of that thing.
Yeah. And then recently we've introduced a new concept that we're both still fleshing out for our people. So we have getting bigger, we have getting smaller than human, with a simple idea that when you are human sized, you're connected. You're connected to yourself, you're connected to your people, and we'll get to this, but you're also, it's easier to notice your connection with God when you're human sized. When you get bigger, you tend to like move into self. I'd say it's like self-aggrandizement. You're depending on self to, and you, it's like you take up all the space in the room. And then as it relates to God, the way we would say it is you kind of take up all that space where you're aware of God. So it's like you blow through your awareness of God as you get bigger. Then when you get smaller, it feels like you're moving into like self-protection. We've both been in meetings where we can tell somebody no longer feels safe to share what they really think.
Yeah.
That'd be an example of getting smaller. Okay, so then we've introduced recently this new idea and we're still trying to figure out the best thing to call it, but it's like the category of people that they don't just get bigger or smaller, they dehumanize another person. Talk to us about examples of that.
Like all these things, it's a scale. And so I'd say maybe the small scale or that doesn't feel like quite dehumanizing, but I believe it is for me, if somebody is driving slow in the left-hand lane, I immediately think that they just don't know how to do anything as a human being. Like I don't know how they put their pants on in the morning.
Yeah, I
just
it's probably not a stick shift. I mean, there's got to be an automatic
clearly
car.
Not, right. I just find myself going from, man, there's 100 reasons why somebody could be driving that way. And I immediately put them into this category of idiot.
Yeah.
Right. And then I think at the larger scale where you look at it on social media or politics, where when we can't handle the dissonance of somebody that thinks differently than we do, we almost feel like we have to dehumanize them so that we can feel better about being human ourselves.
Yeah.
And family systems, you know, like if somebody in your family has been hurt by somebody else, maybe an extended family member, it's pretty easy to dehumanize that person that hurts somebody that you love.
Yeah. Yeah. So on the road, I wouldn't call it road rage, what you're describing, but the irritation of somebody in the left lane, you have dehumanized them in your head. They're no longer a nuanced human being.
Right.
They're like a two-dimensional caricature. Absolutely. That would be one sign that you've dehumanized.
Yeah.
So, Jimmy, another sign I think that you're dehumanizing someone is when you make a generalization about them. So, like, I did a whole episode on how are we in North America going to survive the 2024 year because it's an election year for us.
Yeah.
And what I notice is how often we dehumanize each other in our political conversations by making these wild generalizations about each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where have you seen that at play?
It's this idea of cognitive dissonance. If I can't figure out how to make both these things true. And so I think that we have to generalize because if we make them human size, like let me give a specific example. Let's think about any of the topics that are really contentious about, you know, whether it's abortion or it's gun laws or any of those things. We see somebody who thinks differently than us and go, man, how can they also be human? Because I just can't make sense of that. Like how can, I think it's just a defense mechanism because it takes skill to be able to hold dissonance and go, it could also be true that this person who believes completely differently than me has really good reasons why they believe that way. It doesn't mean that they're right. It's not trying to rationalize their decision and say, oh, they're also right and truth is general.
Right.
But when you add some dimensionality to somebody, then you can at least come up with some reasons why they might have landed there.
Yeah.
I guess. I don't know if that's helpful.
It's such a fundamental part of what we do in our work is we help people notice when they're no longer human-sized. And therefore, of course, when they're no longer treating each other as human-sized, which we happen to believe is what Jesus requires us to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So like when Jesus talks about loving your enemy, one of the most tangible ways you can love your enemy is treat them human size, see them for who they really are.
Yeah. Which is difficult to do.
I know when I was a full-time pastor, you know, I'd always take criticism so personally, the temptation for me, kind of like when you're seeing someone drive in the slow lane, in the overtaking lane, I would turn that person into a monster. It wasn't that I diminished them, but I was still dehumanizing them.
Yeah.
I would exaggerate their criticism. I'd also move into self-pity for myself. These are signs, I think, that I was disconnected.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where it relates to this show of being human is a lot of the work we do, Jimmy, is we teach people that this is a way to connect to God. so that when you're no longer human-sized, you're disconnected. Of course, you're not actually disconnected from God. You're just disconnected from awareness of God.
Right.
Yeah, talk to us about that in your own life. How has this helped, or where have you noticed where you feel connected and disconnected?
I'm an overfunctioner, and so my go-to is to be bigger than human-sized.
Yeah.
Or I try and take on things that are too big. And the cycle that happens with me is that I try as hard as I can, and it doesn't pan out. Whatever it is that I'm trying to control or fix or improve, it will never get there. I'm a perfectionist, and so I'm searching for something that is unattainable.
Yeah.
So inevitably, I hit the end of my energy or my skill set or whatever, and then I just fall and say, God, you're going to have to take it from here. It's me until I get to the end, and then it's God.
Yeah, right.
Right?
Right.
I only get there because I'm like, well, clearly I can't do it anymore. I have no energy left. Yeah. God, take it from here. It's like a baton, you know, pass. And it's like, okay, why don't you take it?
How long have you been a follower of Jesus, would you say?
I don't remember a time when I didn't believe that Jesus was real.
Yeah.
So.
And your default posture, mine's the same, is self before God.
Right.
Yeah, mine too. Shoot.
It's a rhythm, right, of every day. And I think that's what, you know, the Bible talks about, of dying to self. It's dying to this need to be gods ourselves. But yeah, I think that when I can recognize, let's do the opposite of when I get smaller, that's when I let the voice of my inner critic rule the day, of I actually don't think I'm good enough or good at all or good, able to do anything. And it pushes me down to be smaller than human sized.
Yeah.
So I'm believing the voice of my inner critic over the voice of the creator of all things.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's that balance of moving forward with God. It's not like I just say, God, you're going to take this as soon as I wake up. It's more of, God, I know you're already in control. You're already moving forward. And it's that invitation to join him.
Yeah.
Of using the skills that I do have to improve and fix and whatever, but doing them with God instead of out in front of him.
Yeah.
That's the human-sized thing for me, is that I can pretty quickly see when I get off balance by the fact that I've gotten bigger or smaller.
It's taken quite a while, but I've learned to feel in my body when I'm relaxing into God's presence. That's now become the sign for me, is I can feel in my body what you're describing. So what we teach folks, for those of you who are newer to our work, is when the human gets bigger, they've kind of moved into self-righteousness. And when they get smaller, they've moved into either self-pity or self-survival. Sometimes it's self-pity, where you're like, oh man, my life's so hard. Why doesn't anyone come and rescue me from it?
Right.
But sometimes it's self-survival, where you're saying to yourself, the only way I'm going to thrive in this world is if I protect myself. We no longer trust the protection of God. And that gets pretty complicated, particularly for those who are carrying trauma or have had real, real wounds, which we both have our own journey, and we both know people that have lived that way.
Yeah.
So then over time, we're learning to notice in our body how to relax into human size, which then opens our soul, I think, more readily into God's presence. And then a tradition that we both have is lighting a candle. How does lighting a candle help you?
An invisible God, I think, is just difficult to follow and connect with sometimes. And so when I started this practice, I'm a pessimist too, I think, just at heart. Mm. I didn't think it was going to
be probably not going to work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I was willing to do it, right? Yeah. I've been really floored at how helpful it is, because it is so real, right? It's something that you can see, you can feel the heat of. It's in the same room as you. And God is as present as the flame that I can see and feel.
Yeah.
And it bridges that gap that felt sometimes unbridgeable, of like, man, how do I know that God's here? Something I believe, right?
Yeah.
But I don't know how to feel all the time.
Yeah.
It kind of bridges that plane for me.
Yeah. Would you light the candle for
Absolutely.
Us?
Absolutely.
Great. I love how you told us that it's like you were skeptical but open to it. What comes to mind is that wonderful phrase, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief.
Yeah.
The other thing I'm thinking of, Jimmy, even as I just watched you light it, is it just keeps occurring to me with my own doubts. Well, I'm putting my faith in something. Like, it's not that I'm either putting my faith in Jesus or I'm living by certainty in something else. And I just keep having to remember God's presence with me versus there is no God or God doesn't care. One of those is really good news.
Right.
And the other two are really bad news. And it's like, well, I would rather just put my faith in a good story.
Right.
So this helps me with that as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
In our broken world, it can be hard to see how Jesus is at work making all things new. That's why every day, CT testifies to the reality that Jesus is alive, transforming his world and bringing his kingdom to bear through redemptive storytelling and global reporting. Whether it's a pastor in Brazil who uses CT in Portuguese to lead his ministry, or a young believer who wants to think biblically about our culture, CT comes alongside believers to illuminate what it looks like to follow Jesus in today's world. Jesus is transforming his world. CT is equipping his church. Give a gift of $20 to provide 150 more people with redemptive storytelling, global perspective, and thoughtful podcasts. Give now at morect.com/equip.
So there are all kinds of tools that over the episodes, you'll be coming on a few episodes this year and next year. And as you do, we're going to actually teach a tool that we've been teaching for a while. And today's tool is triangulation.
Yeah.
Tell us what triangulation is.
Oh, man. It's one of those topics that is pretty simple and straightforward, maybe at the surface, but it can get pretty complex. And so I think at its simplest form is that two people can't carry a bunch of anxiety together. There's just a pretty limited amount of anxiety that you and I can carry between the two of us. You can obviously grow your capacity for that. But when it gets more than the two of us can manage, then naturally we bring in a third person as a way to vent anxiety or have a third person really share the anxiety in the system. And so gossip is always triangulation, especially when you're in middle school or maybe even high school when you're like, oh, I like so-and-so. Will you go tell them for me or pass them this note? Message carriers are always triangulation.
Yeah.
It's when it's best for two people to continue to work out their issues between each other, but they decide to go sideways. Sideways energy, a phrase that you like.
Yeah.
In its simplest form is that. I think that what makes it complex is that triangles aren't always bad. Triangles are just the way that we relate as humans. And so because we're all interconnected, you can imagine that there's just this really complex version of triangles. It almost looks like a geometry image or something to where we're all connected to different triangles. And it's not bad until we start using those to, like, anxiety will follow a path through the triangles and it'll make a problem more complex than it needs to be because of all the people that have now been kind of triangled into it.
Yeah. So there's a form of triangulation. In North America, they call the game telephone.
Yeah.
But the idea that when you have a circle of people and one person says something and then it's radically different as it goes around.
Yeah.
There's a form of that going on with triangulation. Why does triangulation create anxiety in people?
Well, you talk about the four spaces.
Yeah.
There's different places where anxiety resides. And I think that of those spaces that involves triangulation is third space, which is the space inside somebody else.
Yeah.
And so if I'm worried about what you're thinking or I'm upset about what you did, you're thinking, if I don't bring that between us, whether I'm talking to somebody else about it or I'm just sitting in it with myself, it can go nowhere other than just generate more anxiety. You can't ever solve it without involving the person that you're stuck in their mind about. And so I think that triangulation inherently means that I'm now talking to a problem I have with you, with my other friend.
Yeah.
Usually that's not going to resolve the problem.
Yeah, sometimes venting to a friend is helpful.
Yeah, especially counselors and therapists.
Yeah, but if that's all you ever do,
right.
If that's your habit.
Yes.
And then if you get your kicks out of it, right? Like there's people that enjoy talking behind each other's back.
Yeah.
So when I'm doing consulting for organizations, I bet the most common Zoom or phone call I get is somebody is anxious about a case. They've got a situation and it almost always involves a team member and the relationship with that team member is generating anxiety. So they call me. I'm sure you've had this happen too.
Oh, yeah.
More often than not, Jimmy, they will tell me what's going on. They give me a remarkably insightful blow-by-blow. He's doing this, I'm doing that, she's doing this. This is what that makes me think. And my most common piece of advice is to say, what would it take for you to tell her what you just told me?
Oh, I could never do that.
Yeah, why is that? Why is that so hard to do?
I mean, it's all these tools that we teach, right? It's this inability to be your full self in the presence of somebody else without tending to either enmesh or detach from them. And so I think that depending on what your proclivities are, they come to you because they feel like it's safe. This isn't a highly anxious situation to share this. They're sharing something that was highly anxious, but when they get back in front of that person, all that anxiety resumes.
Yeah.
Right. And so they can tell it to you because the anxiety's down. Yeah. But because anxiety disconnects us from ourselves and other people, it's just very likely that when they get back in there, anxiety's high. The habit that got them into that place, I think, usually takes over.
Yeah.
It's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right. Yeah, no, I used to be afraid to tell people what I thought because I was afraid of hurting them. So I was therefore over-functioning in that third space, doing their work for them and really robbing them of the opportunity.
Yeah.
There are situations where the reason people are gossiping is they've actually have a real reason to no longer feel safe.
Right.
To tell the truth.
Yeah.
That's more nuanced. It's still triangulation. It's still generating anxiety. But I'd hate for some leaders to be watching or listening to this because I've been in organizations where gossip is so stamped out that the leader never looked in the mirror to see if maybe the reason there's so much gossip is the leader can't be given the truth.
Right.
What's your word on that? How do we help people? Like some people triangulate to gain power because they feel powerless.
Right.
That's where it gets nuanced, I guess.
It does. And that's where I was saying triangulation, it can be simple, but very complicated is that you end up giving these kind of broad brush statements that if you take them all the way to the bank, then you're like, wait a second, this doesn't work in this scenario. And so I think that gossip is always harmful.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Venting would be maybe different than gossip, I suppose, sometimes, right? Especially in certain contexts. If you know that the person, there's a blow-off valve that needs to happen. And so you're choosing the lesser of the evils and going, I just need to get it out. Because if I don't get it out with you, I'm going to blow up with this person or something like that. But you were talking about a leader that can't take criticism. And so it's almost that if you look at people and systems, right? I think that's, we learned all this stuff from systems theory.
Yeah.
And if you stop looking at each individual and start taking into account the system, that's when a lot of this becomes clear. Because if you're saying, okay, yes, gossip's bad, let's stamp it out. But then the reason why it's so rampant is because a problem needs to be solved. You know, something needs to change and they can't go to the leader. It's not like anxiety just dissipates on its own.
Yeah.
I guess is my point. It has to have either, you know, people with tools and managing it in themselves, or it's just going to find its way through the system.
Yeah. So if you are a leader, like this is really a podcast for all humans, but if you happen to be a leader in a workplace and gossip is very frustrating to you, it's frustrating to us too, but it is helpful to go to the people that are in the habit of gossip and come underneath them with a curious question and ask them, is there something in our organization or something in me where you don't feel safe to be exactly yourself? And of course, that's complicated. They may not feel safe to tell you the truth.
Right.
There are people that wasn't actually it. They just are emotionally immature.
Right.
In just fact. But there are others that say, oh yeah, like I tried to speak up and I was shut down. That's a more systemic way to help an organization, I think.
Yeah. And I know we're talking about two different spaces and they kind of apply the same tools. If you're talking about a meeting or a friend group,
yeah.
If the meeting is run in such a way that everybody can't share, feel safe to share in the meeting, then there's going to be the meeting after the meeting,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because it's going to have to come out. And so the way to be able to manage it is to help it come out in the meeting. But in a friend group, it's the same way. If your friend group has a particular, you know, character in it that is the one that's generating all the anxiety, if that's not addressed, then they will rule the show. That because of that presence, the dynamic will continue. So it's the nerve, I guess, to be able to do the counterintuitive move of moving towards the anxious person or the anxiety and try and not stamp it out or like, oh, we need to contain it, but really like say, man, what's going on? Like, yeah. The curious question is the magic there.
Yeah. Okay. So just to help people understand, we're talking about triangulation. We also use the word triangles. There actually is a subtle difference. So let's use my family, for example. There's my wife and I, and we have two boys that are out of the house. We have one daughter still at home. So in many ways, Lisa and my daughter and I are a triangle. There's three of us in a relationship. But there might be a way that one of us would triangulate against the other.
Right.
So a triangle itself is fine. It would be weird if my daughter Kaylee came to me and said, you know, Lisa has to be in the room. Like, that's odd. Right. But if she were to come to me and say, Dad, you know how mom is. Now we're in a triangulation.
Right.
Yeah. So triangulation can get really sticky, especially in fields of secret keeping or discretion or when someone's venting.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're looking for is patterns, right? Is the habit when somebody's always doing that. That's their first go-to. All right. So for many of you who are watching or listening this, you've been on this journey with us for up to 5 years now. We started these conversations in a podcast 5 years ago with the Being Human show. We're just a handful of episodes in. But some of you who are newer to the show, you have already discovered the delightful gauntlet of anxiety questions that we typically ask our guests. But when I've got Jimmy or my wife Lisa with me co-hosting, we don't inflict. It just feels weird, Jimmy. We've talked about these things for so many years. It feels weird. I don't think I could rattle you with a gauntlet.
Sure.
So what we do between me, Jimmy, and Lisa is we simply catch you up as an audience on two very simple things. Number one, what is a source of anxiety that I'm working on right now? You know, you and I are not the gurus who have graduated from being anxious. We are just growing in our awareness of it. So that's the first question. And then the second question, more on the proactive side, what's a life-giving habit that you are doing that connects you to yourself, your people, and to God? Let's do the first question first. What is a source of anxiety or a pattern in your life that you've been noticing lately that you're actively working on?
So I grew up in the South. One of the cardinal sins in the Bible Belt South was to be selfish.
Yeah.
You know, rather be caught stealing than be accused of behaving in a selfish way. Obviously, being selfish leads you down a road that is not good. So I believe that that's a value, that it's important.
Yeah.
But man, when my kids show up in a way that's selfish, I recognize in myself going from 0 to 100, like, I will not raise selfish kids. And they're 8 and 10,
yeah.
Right? You know, I find myself saying things like, you're acting like a child. You know, I'm like, wait a second, you are a child.
Yeah.
You know, like, just calm down, Jimmy. And so what I'm really working on is, you know, being able to have conversations about, hey, if you're selfish, this is where that road's going to lead. So I still need to be a parent and teach my kids. But man, that's been not fun to uncover.
I don't know if my kids are watching or listening to this. I know they have tuned in from time to time, but I would say the besetting sin of my parenting was expecting an adult brain out of my children.
Right.
Like, it's just, oh man, I've done that so much. Okay. So an area I'm working on, I'm asking God, because I travel a lot and I just this week kicked off a really heavy travel season. I kind of travel in batches. The next 2 months, lots of travel. When I feel dehumanized by customer service agents. And so just the nature of travel nowadays is delays. It's just, that's going to happen. And I did really well on this trip. I got delayed, I think, 5 times, something like that. And instead of getting irritated at the delay, and then when I interacted with customer service agents, who oftentimes, because of the company they're in, they're not given any real power. That's my real beef. It's not with that human. It's that someone in leadership made sure that that human actually can't help me.
Right.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think I actually did well. And what I've been working on is thanking God that I get to travel. Mm. That's actually helped me. So that's my current one. Then the second question is, you and I both have life-giving lists. What's just one life-giving habit that you're practicing right now?
Yeah, you said that you've been doing show and tell.
Show and tell. It's been fun.
So I brought this. This is one of my Lego creations. I don't know where I'm supposed to hold this.
Yeah.
Legos is a life-giving habit for me, especially building with my kids, 8 and 10. One of my favorites is, I mean, I like, you know, following directions, but just getting—
Can I take a look at that?
Yeah,
I have not played with Lego in several years.
Oh, man. I just like building things from the pieces that we have, just spare pieces.
Isn't a kit. This is just you and kind of invented this.
Yeah, and it's one of those fun things to where you don't know what you're building until you just start putting pieces together. So it turned into some kind of like Star Wars speeder or something.
Yeah,
Yeah, it's just so fun because I love creating, but I'm not a great blank sheet of paper you know, the world is your oyster, do something. I'm good at making things that already exist better.
Yeah.
And so it's very tangible. You know, my kids can do it with me.
Yeah.
It's life-giving.
Okay. So when we talk about the life-giving list, we're not building Lego for the sake of Lego. There is that extra step. What extra step are you taking that makes Lego help you be connected?
I think that I'm really driven for efficiency and productivity and, you know, moving the ball forward. And I can't think of a whole bunch of things that this would be productive for, yeah. I guess. And
yeah.
So it reminds me to be a child of God, but then just an employee of God,
yeah.
You know? And then obviously the relational time with my kids is so life-giving to remember to slow down and kind of get on the floor. And I was once a kid myself. And so being able to do that just reminds me, you know, that God created me,
yeah.
I guess, and created my ability to enjoy play.
I think that especially those of us who are in either Western cultures or highly productive cultures, cultures that really value efficiency, the beauty of play is how unproductive it is.
Yeah.
And inefficient it is.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, let me go pull up one of mine. I had the benefit, of course, being in a life-giving office. Obviously, I built the backdrop based on my personal, some of my life-giving things. You and I are both into cars. I've never shown you these, I think.
No.
The Peugeot 206 World Rally Championship car.
Yeah.
So listen, North Americans, we love you, but you're not familiar with the amazing French cars, the Peugeot, the Renault, the Citroën. You actually own one of the few Peugeots in North America,
that's
oddly
right.
enough.
Yeah.
How did you discover the Peugeot rally car?
Obviously, conversations with you, I had heard of it, and then I started to become fond of it because I think the 205 was one of your dream cars
yes.
growing up,
yeah,
right?
The first pocket rocket. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Car and Driver about 10 years ago started doing articles about now you can import one, you know, for $10,000. You can get a, you know, hot hatch from the 80s.
Yeah.
And so then I just started, you know, looking into it, watching videos. And then I did.
Yeah.
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 Just watching videos of people in their 50s and 60s going, is it really as good as we thought it was? Like, should we just leave it in the past or is it actually still good now?
Yeah.
Just watching them with just grins on their faces driving these cars.
Yeah. All right. And then the second one is related. You know, I grew up in a Motorhead family. I was a competitive go-kart racer as a teen. My dad used to be in Formula One in the 60s before I was born. And then, so I spent a lot of my years at the racetrack, if I'm honest, bored. Like the racetrack is no place for a child. You know, when you're in the pit lane, you just have to stay behind the line.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But I have a mad passion for 1960s Italian crazy expensive sports cars. However, as a follower of Jesus, first of all, I couldn't afford one. But even if I could, I don't feel ethically like I could own one justified. This is a 1967 Maserati Mistral.
Yeah.
I believe one of the prettiest designs that Maserati ever put out. And so having the model.
Right.
Yeah, because I think these are worth about $500,000 nowadays. So.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so folks, as we wrap up this episode, just a couple of simple things. Number one, what is a source of anxiety in your life that might be blocking you from being connected, might be making you bigger or smaller, blocking you from being connected to yourself, to your people, but also your awareness of God? A similar question, just coming at it from a different way. What's a life-giving habit? It can be something silly like Lego or collecting model cars. What's a life-giving habit that God has given you because you're God's child? That can just remind you to worship God. We do the life-giving list to stub our toe on the love of God several times a day. I think that's it for me. Any final words from you on your inaugural Being Human podcast episode?
No, I mean, I think it's really interesting to be on camera. We've done this with just audio, but now I'm suddenly worried about where I'm looking.
Such a ball of wax, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, we're going to let the cat out of the bag. Jimmy's coming on next week as well. You are a resident go-to guy on Enneagram. So next week we'll be talking about how Enneagram, reactivity, and anxiety all fit together and how you use it to connect to God.
All right.
All right.
Looking forward to it.
See you next week. Being Human is a production of Christianity Today. It's executive produced by Eric Petrick and Mike Cosper. It's produced and edited by Matt Stevens. The associate producers are Mackenzie Hill and Ray Gilliam, with music by Dan Phelps, mix engineer Kevin Morris, and graphic design by Amy Jones.